For those of you who are new, my name is Leo Busted, and I'm a veterinarian in Pullman, Washington. And when I was a short time in a teaching hospital at Harvard, I, as part of our responsibilities, they weren't really my responsibilities, but we were invited in to do postmortems. These are on people. I've done a lot of postmortems on animals, but not very many on people.
Pardon?
I've done a lot of postmortems on animals, but I haven't done very many on people.
Oh.
And at the Harvard Teaching Hospital, people would die and we'd do postmortems, but I never made any of the postmortems on the children. I couldn't bring myself to do that. And it's interesting that I noted in our son, who is a physician, an internist, and a cardiologist, he restricts his practice to adults. And I believe it's because he cannot stand to see children suffer. And so that's part of what I'm coming from. But the gist of it tonight is this, that and it's probably best exemplified by one night when I was relatively new in Richland, Washington, where I was employed by the General Electric Company in biomedical research in the early 50s. And one night at 12:30 in the morning, I got a call, and this was not unusual because I had a large experimental herd of animals, and they often required my attention at night. But this was different. The people who called said that they thought that I should go to the hospital because they were a member of a church and the pastor was not in town, and that I should go to the church and comfort these people who had lost their son. And this is was a very unusual son. He was a retarded lad, and he'd been dependent on his mother for his entire life, and he was now still just a youngster. And on many occasions, he seemed sort of bent on suicide because he did a lot of destructive things because he didn't understand. And something else had happened. He got something stuck in his throat, and they did surgery, and the child had died. And the physician was there wringing his hands. He didn't know what to say. And here I am, stuttering and stammering and trying to figure out what you do. When the parents are there, of course, in deep grief, and especially, and I think you'll find this out, that for a child like this who is very dependent, the loss seems to be greater. There are guilt feelings. And the mother, who's a member of our congregation, was saying that there could be no God to allow a thing like this to happen. Well, it wasn't too many more years when I got another call one night. It seems like the pastor was always gone. These people had two sons. The first one night had been watching a Hitchcock movie when it was a person in an iron lung on television, and the folks had gone out briefly. And he was, I guess, testing something, and he pulled a plastic bag over his head. And when they came home, he was dead. Well, this isn't the time that they called me. They called me some years later, because the other son had taken his own life, their only other son. And there was a Tanzanian in our church, a remarkable fellow named Eliamon Amina, one of the more remarkable people I've ever met, and certainly one of the most brilliant. But the parents, he was the only pastor, he was a resident sort of in our church. The pastor was gone, and they chose not to call him, which in itself was a problem to me. And so there I am again. And then in my first visit, first of two visits with Paul Tournier. Paul Tournier is one of the outstanding, I guess, Christian psychiatrists in the world. And he's written a lot of helpful books. And one of my burning questions to him was, what do you say to people when they lose a child? And it was very heavy on my mind because our very dear friends in Davis, California at that time, we were at that time at Davis, California, had just lost their firstborn, then a little over 2 years old, in their neighbor's pool. And I had just the 2 days before in Geneva, Switzerland, received a call because Carl Mao, who's an old friend of mine, said that Busted was in town and that he knew something about cancer. And so I got a call from this person who had three daughters, and the middle one had some swelling in her throat, and they had taken her to the doctor, and the doctor said it's cancer. It's childhood leukemia, and the prospects at that time were very poor. And so I had never met him. He called me up. I said, sure, I'll talk to him, and he called me up on the phone at Aki Rolander's house. It was at that time at the Lutheran World Federation. And for 45 minutes, interspersed by weeping, he told me about this and desperately asked if there wasn't some hope. So it was with this in mind that I approached Paul Tournier with this question. To many of my questions, he made a very rapid reply. This one, he did not make a rapid reply. And after some thought, he said, well, you must allow them to articulate their grief. He said, this is very important. And your presence there is very important and not just a sort of a one-shot deal. And then in June of this year, and I'm just picking out some of the highlights. This time it's a person who is a member of our faculty. Well, he's on two different faculties in Washington State University. He and his wife Joanne are both veterinarians. They had four boys, and they are very conscientious parents. And they had been on a overnight by a large a lake, really an impoundment behind the dam. And they had been out on the boat and they'd come in. Everybody had their life belts on and they were going up then to bed down, get ready to bed down for the night. And they took the life preservers off, I should say. And the four-year-old was, they suddenly looked around and he was gone. It was a matter of just seconds. And they didn't find him for several hours. And he was at the bottom of the lake. They'd come back into town and I got a call then. This was from the Methodist Church. Their pastor was gone. And so somebody called me up and wondered if they thought I certainly must get up there to their family right away because they're overwhelmed with grief and it is important that you go there. And so I went there. Well, with a little experience, I guess you get a little better at it. And I was, of course, sympathetic. The chief went, fortunately, with me. And I brought something along this time. I guess each, and you must recognize that each situation is different. In this case, I brought really three things. I left these two books with them with markers in them of what I wanted them to read, and I was very firm that I wanted them to read this. And one of them is what Al Rognes says in here about looking back on his son's death. And retrospectively, and it's a remarkable, helpful thing. It's when grief won't let you go, and I might read just a little bit of that for you if you've not seen it. It's called A Book of Comfort. And then in this thing called Why Bother About God, and in it you see my marker is still here for them. Why did Charlie die? Well, and then I also gave them something that I had written many years ago. In fact, it was what I told the congregation as I left Richland after 15 years there. And it was about death, and I recalled for them how one faces death. And I closed with a poem again from Al Rognes, the eulogy that he wrote, he was only 24, for his son Paul. And then I told them that I don't understand it probably any better than they do. But that they must carry on. They have three other children, and but they must articulate their grief, and we are there to help. And at any time that he wants to talk to me, I am available to him. And that was one reason I was late coming up here for the June meeting. I was delayed because he called me up and wanted to talk to me before I left town. I also made a point of, I saw Alex in the hallway one day in our building, and when no one was around, I waited till I saw him go down the hall and there was nobody there. And I went up to him and put my hand on his shoulder and asked him how things were going. And then let him tell me how things were going. Now, I tell you this because these are trips that most people don't like to make. And there's a real good reason for it. Usually, and when I was growing up, that's the pastor's job. That's why we hired a pastor. Well, the pastors aren't always there, and they can't do all this. And this isn't a lone wolf kind of an operation. It has to be a community of support for them. The pastor is vital to this, I believe, because of all times, I know a few times when it's more critical that they have access to the pastor. But it is important that we are accessible to them, and if we can't think of anything to say, at least go there and put your arm around them and let them cry on you and have a dry handkerchief that's clean when you go. And after And then, of course, I had an occasion, of course, if you leave something with them, with the instructions that you need them, you'd like to get them back, then they have to bring them back. And you have a chance then to talk to them further. And you might be interested in just what this says here. I know grief when my mother and father died the same summer at 66, but that grief lifted. It was different when our son was killed at 24. My parents' death left me sad to think that I had no one to write to about the joys of their grandchildren. I realized that now I was on the top rung of the ladder and of the generations, and it was lonely up there. I no longer had the luxury of being someone else's child. 12 years later, our Paul's life was snuffed out on a city street, 10 minutes from home, as he was returning from 2 years at Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. You'll hear me say something about this again when I introduce the C.S. Lewis film. Accustomed to the reverse flow of British traffic, he stepped in front of a truck. Now I knew a wrenching grief that fastened itself to me like a leech and wouldn't let go. In my 20 years as a parish pastor, I had tried to help others with the pain of such festering grief. Now it was my turn to suffer. And I'll never forget when somebody asked Carol Hinderly, the first director of Holden Village, how Rognes was taking it. And he says he took it like a man. He wept bitter tears. Day after day, whenever I was pressed with duties, I'd think of Paul. Never during his 2 years in England was I so preoccupied with him. Then, though separated by the Atlantic, I took him for granted. Now separated by death, he became an obsession. I had my faith. I believed that he still lived now beyond another ocean. I believed that he was no longer oppressed by pain or meaninglessness or the prospect of death. In a sense, I knew he had made it in the fulfillment we all desired. Why then the pain? A horde of questions attacked me. Like Jacob, who had loved Benjamin more than the others, had I loved Paul more than my other 4 sons and daughter? Were there things between Paul and me we could have cleared up had we known the end was so near? What had I failed to do for him? Why should God let a promising young man die? And this particular one had a lot going for him, if you know about it. I mean, he was a big winner. Everything he tried, he excelled in. I felt grief and anger and remorse and guilt and loneliness. I cried to God. He came with comfort, but it took time. I had the most trouble with my anger. I resented the words of Job. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I knew the Lord had given Paul to us, but I couldn't believe the Lord had arranged an accident to take him from us. I found myself angry. Not at God, nor at the truck driver into whose path Paul had impulsively stepped. I was angry at the fallen order. In Omar Khayyam's words, this sorry scheme of things entire. Where sin and tragedy and accidents and illness and pain and death can thwart the greater plans of God for his children. I found comfort in thinking that God was indignant with this too. And that in a mixture of love and indignation, he had sent his only son to earth to put in motion a plan that would eventually set things right. I rediscovered a God who suffers with us. I also learned the loneliness of grief. We are a tightly-knit family, and we have a host of warm friends. We shared our grief, but grief leaves you on an island quite alone. Even his mother and I could not really reach into the recesses of each other's grief. George MacDonald's words from the Diary of an Old Soul I found to be true. We all are lonely, Maker, each a soul shut in by itself, a sundry atom of thee. No two yet love themselves into a whole. Even when we weep together, we are two. Guilt was not a serious problem. I could think of nothing serious that had come between us. Even if there were, I quickly reminded myself of the sweeping forgiveness of God that swallows up all of our sins and removes them as far as the east is from the west. And this was critical, of course, in this instance of dealing with Alex and his wife, Joan. You see, here they are. They're probably two of the most conscientious parents I know. I know people that didn't know where their kids were for hours and hours. And this was probably a minute. They'd conscientiously had them all in life jackets. And now, in just a moment, he was gone. He was that kind of an impulsive little boy. Unfortunately, he was the one that everybody knew. Everybody knew him more than the others. And I told them that, from my standpoint, they must not go back and play the record again. That they had to pull as well as they could the blind on it. It serves nothing to go back on that. And I knew of no one who were more serious and conscientious parents than they. Paul, now in heaven and I still on earth, could chuckle over anything that had marred our relationship, whatever that might have been. Still, I felt it was virtually my duty to grieve. If I didn't grieve, had I loved him after all? The magnificent pictures in Hebrews came most to my rescue. In chapter 11, the writer parades the people who have died in their faith and who now, as visitors, are in the celestial bleachers cheering us on. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us all lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us. I pictured Paul in those bleachers, urging me to drop grief and return with zest to the common life and the joy of those around me. And I think this is an important message to them. And they made special note of this when they brought these books back. It isn't as if grief ever quite lets go. But now, except for some swift, unexpected moments when the loss surges in upon me again, the wrenching pain is gone. Some of life's mirth and merriment may be gone too, but sorrow becomes more like a minor chord in a symphony which, with the jubilant majors, combines to make a rich melody. We do not belabor Paul's memory, nor avoid it. I occasionally wear his sweaters. We keep his pictures on display. Even his oar in resting against our bookcase, the oar he used in the Henley Regatta in the summer of 1960. It is at Christmas time that we miss him most. There are no presents for him or from him, nor his Christmas letter. We speak of what he might now have been doing. Sometimes I ponder what pain he may have been spared. The passing of time helps, but it cannot fill the empty place. Fell a great tree and a hole yawns against the skyline. No one ever takes another's place. All of us have a space in existence all our own. Our loss of Paul is indeed well flanked. 12 grandchildren have come since his death. Our other sons do not have their mother's brown eyes and black hair, but they and his sister all reincarnate some of Paul's exuberance and warmth. When King David's little son was sick, the king fasted and prostrated himself before the Lord and would not be comforted. The seventh day the child died. The servants hesitated to tell David that the child was dead, fearing that he would do himself harm. To their surprise, when he heard it, David washed himself, dressed, anointed himself, and sat down to eat. He told his servants, "While the child was still alive, I fasted and I wept. For I said, who knows whether the Lord will be gracious to me that the child may live? But now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me." Well, Paul sleeps. It's your turn, Walt.
I think in the reading from the incident of King David, the question ought to be asked whether it's harder for us to live with the illness of children who do not die with the finality that death brings. I think it's very instructive to encounter that passage from Samuel, because there are some ways in which we can deal with the finality of death. There are other ways in which we cannot deal with continuing illness. And I think the hardest thing is to try to have to be community of support for parents who have to live year after year with children who are perhaps mentally retarded. I have a colleague on the faculty whose daughter is now 15 years old. And I think the difficulty they have in coping with a problem that is continuous and won't go away, or people whose children are ill but not mortally ill, and who are crippled, and they have to live with the crippling effects of a problem with missing limbs, or debilitating disease. That was one of the things I think I wanted to say.
Yeah, and that's very important, because the first incident that I told you about, when this lady said, there can be no God, and this was a handicapped child. And this was one of these cases where she had to be in attention at all times. There wasn't a moment's peace for her during the day. It was complete attention at all times, and when she wasn't paying attention, he might destroy himself. And on several occasions, this is what happened, and he had to be rushed to the hospital. This was not his first trip to the hospital. He had been there many times before, and only this time they did not save him. And that brings out something very important, and I'm glad you brought it up, because this is very important, again, about community, that we are the people that should be helping them. We should go into this mother and say, leave for a few hours and we'll watch. I talked about the tired mother syndrome the other day on raising children. Well, we have to be the good neighbor in this. And this is something like here at Holden, we speak of in raising children, we didn't get into the other night, but we are often other people's parents, and sometimes I may be, or somebody else may be a better parent to my child on occasion, and I a better parent to their child, and we look at them as our children, and I apologize, I'll finish the last paragraph of this because it's important. Paul sleeps in a little windswept graveyard on the prairies of South Dakota next to his grandfather and grandmother, but he lives on in the fabric of many lives he cherished. And I believe ennobled. And with more than wistful longing, I believe that he lives and works in another part of the far-flung empire over which the Creator rules. I will go to him there. It is in the dimensions of the empire that grief comes tremulously to rest. There are many, I think, very helpful things in this book. And it's in our bookstore. And then here, this was very helpful to them in this case, and maybe it wouldn't be helpful in everything, about why, trying to address the issue of why Charlie died, and we don't know why Charlie died.
Can I add three comments?
I'd like to have you know, yes.
Okay. First is, I think that if we try to assess what is the most difficult question that faces us in terms of grief, it's not the death of parents, although that is, I found again the things that Ragnar said terribly significant. When my father died, the first thing one of my best friends said to me was, "You are next in line." At first I didn't quite understand him, but the longer I have lived with that fact, the more profound it is, because as long as our parents are alive, there is still yet some buffer between ourselves and final responsibility for our lives and our world. And the second thing is that that we are next in line for the grave. It's you know, you just move up to the front rank, and you know that your generation is now the generation that has to get ready to die. But that's not the most, and similarly, we think that the death of a spouse can be the worst thing. It is not. I think really, universally, it has been the death of children. That, because it is at that moment, first of all, that our own utter helplessness becomes most manifest. And all of the investment that we have in the future disappears. If anything, parents learn to be responsible for children. Death is a way of saying even that responsibility has limits. It's the most terrifying, the most debilitating, the most lasting experience that we have, the most lasting grief. Okay, so that's the first point. The second point I wanted to make, I think, is that that I feel cheated by anybody who does not share experiences. And the time for us to glean those experiences is not, first of all, when it happens. I've noticed this in many areas of my life. I'm now 50. I deeply resent the fact that people who were 50 a generation before me didn't tell me about what it's like to be 50. And so I think that it's always important. It's never inappropriate for any of us who have experiences to say what it is like, for the dying to tell us what it's like to die, for the bereaved to tell us what it is like to grieve. We can't have enough of that. I treasure every book, every chapter, every reminiscence, every sharing that enables us, you know, our own grief is going to be unique no matter. But it helps us to know somebody has been there before we have. And not only in the moment when it happens, but above all, as we live our lives. I am glad to know now from other people what it is like to be 50. I want to know what it's like to be 75. We are cheated, and we cheat others if we do not both hear and tell what it is like for us to be going through anything. So that's the second point. I guess the third point is that one of the things we're going to experience is the terrible question, why does God do this? And if we want to pursue that question very far, we're finally either going to be very angry with God, or we're going to want to fling away from God altogether and say, there is no God, there can't be a God. That's not bad. Paul Tillich once said, never trust anybody who isn't angry with God. The only people that can ever be trusted to speak to us honestly are people who admit that there have been occasions for anger with God, and of the most militant and extreme kind. And it may last a while, but I don't trust people who are not angry with God.
and who are willing to say it out, flat out. I trust people who can say that. I don't trust people for whom God is always the nicest thing and who are almost afraid to say that they ever have any anger or any fear or any doubt or any problems. Faith does not exist in the absence of doubt. It exists in conflict with doubt. And the more honest we can be with doubt, the more possibility there will be with faith. Because in the last analysis, our faith clings to the fact that God himself knew what it was like to lose a child.
It was interesting that in my last meeting, which was just a few days before I came here with Alex, that that we sometimes forget then the children. You're comforting the parents. Huh? And you think, well, the kids are kind of running around and you know, so it's just another day for them. But it isn't. And he said that, well, he says, things are improving. He said, the children are sometimes acting, well, in anger. they can't really explain it, but it's as if they're angry and they do things that they didn't do before. And the other thing, another point in this regard that I just recall, well, I recall that I think of it often. I think that we are limited as to how we can help in these situations. If we have not faced the reality of our own death, I'll never forget. When I visited Fritz Norstedt, who was the interim director of Holden Village, who now lives at Leavenworth, and he had two children, his son, well, he had a daughter and then their adopted son, and their daughter was a remarkable lady. She at the age of, in her late 20s, she was married, had a little boy, and she developed an unusual cancer, and was hospitalized. Unfortunately, they didn't get it soon enough. It's one of these that we could manage now. But Fritz came in to see her, and everybody knew it was going to be curtains. So Fritz came in with her husband, and she ran him out of the hospital and told him that they couldn't do her any good until they faced the reality of their own death. And they did some soul searching on this, and I think probably one of the most remarkable evenings I've spent on this was sometime after she died. I was invited to stay overnight with Fritz in his home there in Park Ridge, Illinois. And he then described this whole scene. It was a dinner and he was essentially initiating me into an unusual group in an unusual situation when he told about the last days of his daughter and things they did. They had moved her out of the hospital into the dining room. They'd taken the dining room out, and that was her home. It was the center of activity. And that's where she died. And he told about these great times they had together. And if you are faced with such a situation, I think that's a great place to die, is at home, if it can be arranged. And I think that I don't know if it's still here, and we should check on this, because Fritz did a tape here one time, and it's, I think you'll find it exceedingly helpful. If you haven't had this eulogy, I'd like to read it for you. I've used it a good deal. And then, for those of you who watch C.S. Lewis, then you'll know one time what I did with it. In fact, it was the occasion for my writing to C.S. Lewis.
May I ask one question?
Yes.
In regard to what you said, that when a person like that is angry with God and you ask the question, why? We're facing that now. And it's so hard to know what to say because our good neighbor next door lost her son who was a state patrolman for Oregon. And he had a heart attack and is gone. The only child she had, the only son, and she just cannot accept it. And then, 2 weeks later, she had said she was just angry with God. Why would God have to do this? 2 weeks later now, just before we came, she became desperately ill. She was in the hospital and they had surgery. When they opened her up, she was full of gangrene and they said absolutely no hope for her. And she's in intensive care. Whether she's still there now when we come home, I don't know. But she could not. It was so hard for her to accept. Why did God do it? What do you say?
Let me add an addendum. Just days before she had to go to the hospital, I was walking. Her house is across from ours. I was walking in the street and she called me over and she said, I told God this morning that I wasn't mad at him anymore. She said, I read the Bible, I prayed, I talked with God this morning. And she said, I still don't understand it, but I told God I'm not mad at him. I almost broke my heart here.
Yeah.
And yet rejoice at this.
Yeah. But that isn't to say, you know, that in another time of depression, she will be mad at him again.
I suspect.
You know, it sometimes happens that way. And to say how we will face our own death, of course, is something we can't say. I discussed that with Paul Tournier. He says all predictions are off.
One question that she asked again and again. Her brother-in-law had been in the hospital just before that. After the son was taken, his wife was in the hospital and they had surgery. And this went on and on. She said, why does it have to happen to us? Why does God allow it? What do you think?
Yeah. I don't know, but someday I'll find out. No.
I think the main thing is not to try to talk people out of that. Tell them everything that you can, do everything you can to say you understand. If you were in those circumstances, you would feel exactly that way, that they have every right to ask that question, and not to try to talk them out of it. In their own time, they will see things in another way. And you can't hurry that along. And to add to the burden, we would add to the burden if we would try to say, there's something wrong with your feeling this way, or you ought not to feel this way, or God will punish you for feeling this way, which is the worst thing you can say. Mm-hmm. The best thing is to say you understand it, you would feel the same way, and that you trust them because they're able to talk about it and verbalize it in that way. If we take seriously, see what is happening in all of this is that there is no fudging at that point on the question of God's functioning in the world. If we're willing to say God gives the good days, we also have to be willing to say he gives the bad. If we're willing to say that God sends help, we also have to be willing to say that God has something to do with sickness. But if we're willing to say the second, you know, the bad days and the sickness, then we're also going to have to be willing to be angry.
The Psalms are full of words of people who are fighting with God. It's in the Bible. You know, you've got to look at some of those Psalms sometimes. What are you doing this for, songwriters? There's no fudging on the question. And I think there's something wrong with the religion that says, oh, you ought not feel that way. Can't help our feelings. When the moment arrives, Christians can say to people who are angry with God, not only you have a right to be angry with God, but also God's been where you have been. And that's not a way of trying to talk them out of the anger, but it's a way of trying to say there's more than our anger. And at a proper moment, they will understand it. But as Leo says, you know, we're in and out of that. We're in and out of that. And we will be the rest of our lives. So one day you can be happy, you laid it aside, and another day it'll be back again, and that's the way it is. The main thing is, he does not let go of us, even when we run from him. And that's a great good word.
Would the experience of Christ in the garden be related here?
Well, of course. Anything
this is
related.
A new thought.
A lot of things are related.
My God, why hast thou forsaken me?
Yeah.
That's a new thought to me. Thank you.
You and then you.
I just kind of wanted to add a perspective thought. I think that scripture verse that has been a tremendous help to me in times of sharing grief with one another. The simple words, Jesus wept. I think we're too reserved with our feelings, but I think you understand that he already wept because he knew we were going to lose our children, or that we were going to lose people we loved close to us at different times in our lives, and he already felt that for us at that point. And that is a great comfort to me, and he also cried out in this moment of death. He too could be,
Yeah, many people have discussed this issue from the standpoint that, well, if you're Christians, you shouldn't be sorry when somebody dies, you know. They've gone to heaven, to a better place. And my answer to that is, and that's related to what Carol Hinderly said about Al Rognes. I mean, the Christians love more, so they lose more when they depart. So they weep bitter tears. And you don't have to apologize for it. Yes?
And with the breakup of the nuclear family, this problem is going to be even harder on people, because in the 19th century, you know, when sometimes a family would have 12 children, lose five, death was quite a lot more common, you know, due to scarlet fever, epidemic, things like that. And they had a sort of a built-in emotional system, so that when so someone did die, all the neighbors and all the family would come together, and they had the strength to go through it. But now with the breakup of the nuclear, or with the breakup of the extended family, you sort of find in society a larger of a cold, frigid attitude which tells you to deny this grief, even in the pub. You know, count your blessings. Here you are. You got three meals a day, and you live in the United States of America. You got a lot to be thankful for. Think of the starving people of India. Who are you to feel grief thinking of something as small as the death of a parent or death of a loved one? That's the attitude you get.
Yeah. Now, I'll read you. He was only 24, and unless someone else has something. He had been center on the football team, steersman on the crew, childhood, high school, Christian College, Oxford. The years had mounted upward in a spiraling crescendo. In George MacDonald's words, he was a gleam-faced, pure-eyed, strong-willed, high-hearted boy, and the rising plateaus were before him. Suddenly, as youth, his life was ended, the roar of a motor, a broken body on a city street. Youth is not a preparation for life. Youth is life itself. There is no time for rehearsal. The great play is on. Every day is another little block of time in which to live, to love, to serve, to weep, to laugh. You cannot employ today only to set the stage for tomorrow. There may be no tomorrow. Long years ago, a youth of 33 rides to his death on a cross. Across the centuries, this young man summons other young men and women to join him and to give him the vibrant, aspiring years of their youth. These years may be the only ones that can be given, for there may be no more. And what years they are, exuberant, gay, warm, sensitive, and strong years. If the Lord can have these years, then he has captured the best. Perhaps these are enough for him. You may have 70 to give him. You may have but 84. However long or short, having given him your years, when death makes his capricious attack, the Lord of the cross and the empty grave will set you on your feet again and put you to work in the imperishable sectors of his kingdom. Yes, Chief.
I just wanted to make the point that struck me with the O'Harios when they lost their little boy. They seemed to find the community very supportive, especially people that they had not known, even known, who had lost a child. They could come and respond in a way that the rest of us, even if we wanted to, we can't, because we haven't been there. And there are, why don't you tell a little bit about that?
In the town that I live and work in, there's a group that's called the Society of the Compassionate Friends, and it's made up of parents who've lost children. Mm. And that's kind of one, that's the membership requirement. And they do, the little that I know of them, they do make contact at the hospital or something, just to let parents know that they are available, they're quite a dynamic group there, quite a large number of them.
This is important.
Society for the Compassionate Friends, or of the Compassionate Friends, I don't remember.
And what city is this in?
Oh, what city? Yeah. St. Cloud, Minnesota.
I've tried to get one of those going. What you don't realize, in a college town, and I ran across this, so I got after the ministers and also the counseling center, that they ought to form a group, because a lot of times when you have 16,000 or 17,000 students like we have, some parent and brother or sister is dying frequently, and maybe it's their first year or even their fourth year at school, but especially their first year, it's terrible for them, and there isn't anybody really. There isn't a group to kind of look after it. Yes.
There is a book by Weatherhead called The Will of God, and I really have some problems dealing with what Walt said earlier. In the book, he discusses the will of God, and it is not the will of God that anyone should die prematurely or in the wrong place. And he deals very effectively with this, and I would commend the book to you for that kind of...
The Will of God by
Weatherford.
Yeah. Thank you. I believe it's time for Vespers, and I hope this has been helpful to you.